Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Socrates, narrated by Lynn Redgrave, Part 2.
Beyond these occasional unflattering glimpses, we know nothing of Socrates' relationship with Xanthippe. Socrates seems to have been on friendly terms with some of Athens' most influential citizens, in spite of his disheveled appearance and his indifference to wealth and power. He was often invited into their homes for the evening, and many of their sons seem to have enjoyed his company during the day. He frequented the agora, the Athenian market, searching for people to engage in philosophical discussion. Plato may have first encountered Socrates in just this setting, and he later provided Socrates' explanation for why he was so popular with so many wealthy young men.
The young men who follow me, those who have the most leisure, the sons of the richest men, enjoy hearing people being examined. And they often imitate me and then try to examine others. And then I think they discover a great abundance of people who think they know something, but know little or nothing.
Some of Socrates' well-heeled friends would play important, though hardly admirable, roles in Athenian history. One such friend was Alcibiades, who became a leading political and military leader before betraying Athens at the most crucial point in her death struggle with Sparta. Socrates' friends also included Critias and Charmides, two of the most evil men in Athenian history. Immediately after Athens surrendered to Sparta, Critias and Charmides led the so-called 30 tyrants in a murderous reign over Athens. Socrates has been blamed for shaping the fate of these men, and the extent of his responsibility remains a matter of controversy today. By the time Socrates was in his mid-40s, he was well known in Athens. When, in 423 BC, the comic poet Aristophanes first produced his play entitled Clouds, one of its central characters, as we've seen, was a buffoonish, charlatan philosopher named Socrates. The chorus describes Socrates in a way that undoubtedly is intended to be the philosopher of that same name, depicting many of the well-known characteristics of the philosopher.
You walk along the streets, rolling your eyes, barefoot, enduring many hardships. You gaze up at us, the clouds.
This play did much to spread Socrates' reputation. But Socrates must already have been well known as an intellectual of some significance. Otherwise, his portrayal as a pretender to great insights would have failed to achieve its comic effect. No one tells us why or when Socrates first became interested in philosophy, but it's likely that he perceived himself to have a religious duty to engage his fellow citizens in philosophy. Most of Socrates' fellow Athenians were traditional believers in such deities as Zeus, Hera, Athena, Apollo, and Aphrodite. The immortal Greek gods were much more powerful than human beings, but they were driven by the same thoughts and passions as humans. Most Athenians believed that when the gods were pleased, they bestowed great good on humans. When they were angry, they imposed the greatest of evils. So it was important to stay on their good side. How did Socrates' religious mission begin? Plato tells us that one of Socrates' friends, a man named Chaerephon, traveled to the oracle at Delphi. He asked whether there was anyone wiser than Socrates, and the priestess of Apollo responded that no one is wiser than Socrates. According to Plato, here is how Socrates reacted when he heard about what the priestess had said.
When I heard these things, I was puzzled. What does the god mean? And what riddle is he setting forth? For I knew that I am wise, neither much nor little. What then does he mean in saying that I am the wisest? For clearly he is not lying. That is not possible for him. And for a long time I was puzzled about what he was saying. And then, with great reluctance, I did a turnaround and started to investigate him.
Socrates attempts to disprove the oracle by finding at least one person wiser than himself. He discovers no shortage of fellow citizens who think they know how to live, but his questioning reveals their ignorance. At least Socrates knows that he does not know how to live, and in this important sense, he is wiser than they are. Socrates realizes that those who think they know how to live would be immeasurably better off if they understood their ignorance. Socrates believes that Apollo himself conveyed this message through his oracle, and he concludes that he has been given a divine mission to improve his fellow citizens.
Thus I go around even now and seek and examine on behalf of the god any citizen or stranger I consider to be wise. And when he seems not to be, I assist the god and reveal that he is not. And from this activity, I have no leisure to engage in any matter pertaining to the city worth mentioning, or to my affairs. But I am in great poverty on account of my service to the god.
Socrates knows that most of his fellow citizens have no desire to test their claims to knowledge, and when his persistent questioning reveals how little they know, they feel tricked and humiliated. In time, some of the Athenian citizens came to feel that enough was enough, and they turned their humiliation into anger. In the spring of 399 BC, when the city of Athens was once again securely in democratic hands, a man named Miletus brought criminal charges against the philosopher. Miletus seems to have been the chief prosecutor, but he was aided by two others, Anytus and Lycon, who brought legal charges against Socrates. Several centuries after Socrates' death, Favorinus, a minor teacher of rhetoric in the 1st century AD, actually saw the formal charges which had been preserved. According to the historian Diogenes Laertius, Favorinus saw charges that have a distinctly religious character.
Miletus, the son of Miletus of Pithos, wrote these things, and swears to them, about Socrates, the son of Sophroniscus. Socrates is guilty of not believing in the gods the city believes in, and of introducing new divinities into the city. He is also guilty of corrupting the youth.
Athenian juries were generally very large to prevent tampering, and Socrates' trial probably involved 500 jurors. A great throng of other Athenians often pressed around the perimeter of the court to hear the proceedings. By custom, the morning was set aside for the prosecution to present its case. Socrates presented his defense in the afternoon. Socrates' trial was called an argon timesis, which means that the penalty was not set by law. Rather, the prosecutor proposed a penalty at the end of the indictment. If convicted, the defendant proposed a counter-penalty, and the jury chose between the two. Miletus asked that Socrates be put to death, and we will see later that Socrates proposed a counter-penalty that the jury did not expect. Plato's early work, entitled Apology, purports to be an account of what Socrates says in his defense, and it is the most famous description of what Socrates said at his trial. Xenophon, the Athenian general, historian, and friend of Socrates, wrote the only other version that survives in its entirety. As many as 7 versions were written in antiquity, and there undoubtedly were others for which no record remains. Xenophon did not actually hear Socrates' speech, but he heard about it from a man named Hermogenes. According to Xenophon, Socrates never seriously attempted to convince the jury that he was innocent.
Others have written about Socrates' trial, and all happen to comment on his boastfulness, which makes it clear that Socrates really did talk that way. But they did not make clear that he had come to the conclusion that death was preferable to life, so that his boastfulness appears to have been thoughtless. Hermogenes, the son of Hipponicus, was a companion of Socrates, and gave reports about him so that his boastfulness appears fitting to his thinking that death is preferable.
Commentators generally conclude that Plato is more accurate than Xenophon in his account of what Socrates actually said to the jury. For one thing, Plato indicates that he was actually present at the trial. Still, Plato's apology is probably not a verbatim report. According to Plato, Socrates believed he could be successful only by addressing what he calls the first accusations against him. These are the falsehoods, rumors, and innuendos that had been passed around Athens for many years. Socrates is quoted as saying,
"I am in the right, men of Athens, to make a defense against the first false accusations and the first accusers, and then against the later accusations and the later accusers. For many have accused me to you for many years, although they have said nothing true. And these I fear more than those around Anytus, although they too are dangerous. But these others are more dangerous, who got hold of most of you when you were children and made accusations about me. All lies. That there is a man called Socrates, a wise man, who thinks deeply about the heavens and searches after all things below the earth, and who makes the weaker argument the stronger."
Socrates points out that two of the so-called first accusations can be found in Aristophanes' play Clouds. The first accusation is that Socrates is a nature philosopher who thinks everything can be explained scientifically. He leaves no room for belief in the gods. The second accusation is that Socrates is an immoral sophist, twisting things around in a way that teaches his pupils to reject the notion of ethical truth. Against the charge of atheism, Socrates can do little more than to deny that he has had anything to do with such scientific investigations. He asks the jurors if they have seen him engaging in such speculations. As for being a sophist, Socrates points out that this charge is especially ironic, since he has no knowledge to convey to anyone. What's more, his poverty is ample evidence that students do not pay him for his teaching. Socrates responds to the specific accusations at his trial by interrogating their author, Meletus. Socrates questions his accuser in a way that's typical of the wiry arguments he earlier used to expose the pretensions of his interlocutors. Meletus had formally accused Socrates of corrupting the youth of Athens, and, according to Plato's account, Socrates defends himself with impatience and sarcasm.
"Now tell us, in the name of God, Meletus, whether it is better to live among good citizens or bad. Answer, I am not asking you anything difficult. And do not bad people work some evil on those who are always near them, and the good work some good on those always near them?"
"Well, of course."
"And is there anyone who wishes to be harmed by those who are around him rather than benefited?" "Answer, the law requires you to answer. Is there anyone who wishes to be harmed?"
"Clearly not."
"Come then. Do you accuse me here before the court of corrupting the youth and making them worse, voluntarily or involuntarily?"
"I say voluntarily."
"Are you so much wiser than I am at my age, that if I shall make any of those around me bad, I shall be in danger of being harmed by him, and that I do such an evil to myself voluntarily, as you say?" "Well, I am not persuaded by you about that, Meletus, nor do I think any other man is either. So, either I do not corrupt the youth, or if I do, I do so involuntarily. Either way, you are accusing me wrongly."
In part, Socrates intends to show that Meletus is accusing him in a way that is not fully thought out. But Socrates is also making the point that he would not willingly harm himself, which is precisely what he would have been doing if, as Meletus says, he had corrupted the youth. Plato's Apology is best known for Socrates' unyielding defense of the philosophical life. Socrates is convinced that by badgering people to examine their beliefs, he is far from corrupting anyone. In fact, he is their greatest benefactor. Socrates tells the jury that he steers his companions away from their less valuable material concerns and towards the most valuable concern of all, which is moral virtue.
For I go around doing nothing else but trying to persuade you, young and old, not to care for your bodies, nor your money, more than your soul, that it may be as good as possible, saying that virtue does not come from money, but from virtue come money and all other good things for men, both in private and in public.
This is the end of part 2. Please download part 3 to continue.